technically coming up on the next recurrence that could possibly happen. So that doesn't mean it'll happen tomorrow, but it is close at hand, and we're aware of that.
Gauging earthquake risk in the Matanuska Valley. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a call for more radiation monitoring stations in Alaska.
If it's in Bethel or nearby Bethel, I think that's only prudent for our residents of the region.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
Alaska lawmakers today moved Cora Campbell's nomination for Commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game one step closer to confirmation. The 31-year-old Campbell initially faced opposition due to her youth and commercial fishing background, but representatives from a number of fishing organizations called into the House Resources Committee to support her candidacy. Jerry McCune of the United Fishermen of Alaska says he sees Campbell's youthfulness as an asset that will allow her to bring fresh perspective to the department. The committee also heard two calls in opposition to her confirmation. Campbell will face another hearing before the Senate Resources Committee next week. Her nomination will be finalized after approval from a joint session of the legislature. While state and federal officials have been closely monitoring the situation at the nuclear power plant in Japan, they say that the failure there has not had any impact in Alaska.
All air monitoring stations are indicating background levels.
That's John Edwards, a radiation expert with the Environmental Protection Agency. The EPA has decided to expand its RadNet system, which examines air and drinking water for radiation contamination. While the EPA already had radiation monitors in place in Anchorage, Juneau, and Fairbanks, the agency is setting up new ones in Unalaska and Nome, along with an extra one in Juneau, to cover a greater geographic area across the state. The monitors arrived in Unalaska and Nome yesterday, and they'll be up and running by next week, says Bernd Gilly, chief of the Alaska State Public Health Laboratories.
Right now, those two new devices are still being set up and calibrated.
Greg Wilkinson is a spokesman for Alaska's Department of Health and Social Services, and he says that the state does not expect those monitors to pick up high levels. He said that radiation levels would have to be 40 times higher than usual for there to be any health concern.
And sometimes you get a little more. Maybe you go to the dentist. Maybe you go through screening at the airport. Maybe, you go in, you break your arm. You go in, you get more radiation exposure in certain ways. It all depends on how much exposure you're getting, how quickly you're getting that level of exposure, and how long that level of exposure is expected to last.
In Unalaska, residents have continued on with their daily lives. Public Safety Director Jamie Sunderland stressed that community members should be doing exactly that and avoiding medical precautions that could have adverse side effects.
Right now, there is no threat. There's no reason to panic right now. You don't need to be taking iodine.
In Kodiak, officials say they are in close contact with state emergency coordinators to monitor any possible threat of radiation contamination blowing over the Gulf of Alaska. Kodiak Fire Chief Rome Kamai heads the community's emergency planning effort.
Myself, the police chief, have been checking the State Emergency Coordination Center's website daily. They've been putting out a situation report daily with a few other attachments, either from the Department of Health and Social Services here in Alaska or from the EPA or some of the other federal partners that are providing information.
More information is available at the Environmental Protection Agency website as well as the State of Alaska. Links are at our website, aprn.org. Following the heightened awareness of a possible radiation threat, Representative Bob Huron of Bethel is asking for monitoring equipment in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. KYUK's Angela Denning-Bards reports.
Although no radiation has been detected yet, Representative Huron wants to be proactive. He sent a letter to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation requesting the installation of a monitor in Bethel, similar to the ones that are already in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. Huron says his letter was triggered by a concerned constituent in Bethel.
And so we did a little bit of research, and that's when I decided to send a letter to the Commissioner of DEC, Larry Hartig, for him to give consideration to our region.
Huron's letter to the DEC underscores the need for early detection if radiation drifted this far west. He says that Bethel is an important regional hub in southwest Alaska, and a monitor would detect radiation before it spreads to the interior or south central.
Strategically, we're in a good spot, large hub. If it's in Bethel or nearby Bethel, I think that's only prudent for our residents of the region.
We are monitoring radiation in Bethel.
That's Bethel's Fire Chief George Young talking on a KYUK call-in show. He says the local fire department has a few types of Geiger radiation detectors already that he himself uses anytime there's a public concern.
One measures lower level particulate ash sort of stuff, and the other measures real dangerous core of reactor meltdown kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just want to let everyone know we do have the capability to measure that. I've been doing it since Friday.
Young says the monitor that Huron is requesting could enhance their monitoring efforts. Huron says he's waiting to hear back from the DEC about his letter. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
Alaskans are no strangers to earthquakes, and since the recent disaster in Japan, they are focusing anew on coping with one. Matanuska Susitna Borough officials have long urged residents to plan ahead for a natural calamity, and as KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, those concerned about taking action now can gain valuable tips at an upcoming disaster preparedness workshop.
The March 27, 1964 earthquake that rocked Alaska coastal villages near Prince William Sound generated a tsunami that wiped out the villages of Chenega and Portage and inundated Seward with a flaming oil-coated wave. Although about only 131 people died in that disaster, the 9.2 quake was, at the time, the second largest in recorded history. Alaska is on the Pacific Ring of Fire, which generates 90% of the Earth's earthquakes. Tom Smeda, emergency manager for the Mat-Su Borough.
Since Alaska has probably 2,000 to 3,000 earthquakes a month, and we have the Castle Mountain Fault in particular, which we are especially concerned about because it travels down through the Matanuska Valley and across the Susitna Valley. Now the recurrence rate for that is on the order of something over every 1,000 years, but we're technically coming up on the next recurrence that could possibly happen. So that doesn't mean it'll happen tomorrow, but it is close at hand and we're aware of that.
Smeda says the borough is urging people to get involved in emergency preparedness in a number of ways, using radio ads like this one.
Patty, did you lose power during that last wind event?
I did. We were without power for 12 hours. My well stopped. I went into the garage, turned to my last time I had a kit, which was from that redoubt volcano event, and there was a bug in my water.
Ew, a bug? What did you do?
Well, I was pretty happy to have it, given I had no running water.
Borough emergency officials are hosting workshops and have an internet presence to get information to the public. An emergency preparedness workshop is slated for later this month. Smeda says wildfires are the number one potential emergency in the borough, although other than earthquakes, there are hazards posed by high winds, blizzards, ice storms, not to mention Cook Inlet volcanoes. So it's best to keep an emergency response kit on hand.
There's a lot of common denominators for all disasters, whether it's earthquake or flood or winter storms, and that's that folks should have their own disaster preparedness kit at home with basic supplies like food and water for around 7 days, flashlights, an idea of what they would use for alternative power.
And it does not hurt to put in an extra food stash of canned and dried eats. Experts say if a cataclysm hit the lower 48 states and supply lines to Alaska were cut, Alaska would be reduced to about a 3-week supply of food. Borough emergency personnel keep skills sharp by regular drills with emergency exercises, such as the Alaska Shield exercise, which focuses on earthquake response, and by working with the school district's risk manager, among others.
I'm also working right now with Department of Public Health to conduct another exercise in the area, which will work on how we manage the strategic national stockpile, which is a stockpile of pharmaceuticals and other medicines that would be utilized during a disaster, which may even come into play if we did have a radiation issue.
Remember the Castle Mountain Fault that runs through the Matanuska Valley? Experts will be on hand at the upcoming disaster preparedness workshop in the valley to answer questions regarding the potential for an earthquake. Learn more about earthquakes and how to prepare for one on March 31st at 6:30 at the Central Matsu Public Safety Building in Wasilla. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Juneau man is up for a very special honor.
And any time that we can get that opportunity to go and spend time in the backwoods, twist my arm, make me do it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by Wells Fargo, committed to supporting communities and Alaska residents beyond just their banking needs. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Arctic Slope Regional Corporation shareholders will receive a spring dividend of $16.53 per share in April. The average ASRC shareholder owns 100 shares and will receive $1,653 in total. That's 33% higher than the payout last spring. The distribution pushes the total dollar amount paid in dividends since the company's incorporation above the $500 million mark. The overall net income to shareholders is just over $164 million. The ASRC board typically declares two dividends each year, one in the fall and a second in the spring. This spring's dividend will be issued April 13th. Sitka's spring herring fishery appears on course to top 12 million for the second year in a row. Area management biologist Dave Gordon told the Sitka Chamber of Commerce that the 2011 harvest could exceed last year's take of nearly 18,000 tons. Gordon offered an unusual look this week behind the scenes at one of the state's most lucrative fisheries. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Gordon let the numbers do most of the talking. Between 2000 and 2009, the average herring harvest in Sitka was just under 12,000 tons. The trend in harvest was generally upward, but then in 2010, it took a big jump.
Last year's fishery, we harvested nearly 18,000 tons at a base price of $550 per ton, and that's the price that fishermen get for 10% roe for a total value of $12.3
million. $12.3 million. That's $5 million more than Sitka's halibut harvest, $4 million more than the local sablefish catch, and over twice the value of local salmon trolling. Just the seven individual SACRO herring permit holders in Sitka alone grossed nearly $2 million.
Certainly this time of year, we're not going to see any herring, but where you see sea lions, whales, and birds is you're going to likely find some herring there.
When Gordon puts permit holders on two-hour notice, the SACRO fishery becomes a spectator sport. Many of the openers are within view of the road system, sometimes just off the beach. Although it's exciting for the audience, Gordon prefers to manage at a less frenzied pace. Rather than setting a 30-minute time limit, he'll leave things open-ended and try to get harvest amounts on the fly.
We have four skiffs deployed that are running around in the fishery, and they're looking into nets, and they're making an estimate of how much fish is in there, 50 tons, 100 tons. I mean, it's not real fine-tuned, but it works.
Once the guideline harvest level is reached, usually over 10 days or so of fishing, biologists transition from harvest management to stock assessment. That means mapping the miles of shoreline that show visible spawn and then sending divers to sample the concentration of eggs. In 2010, Gordon mapped 88 miles of herring spawn on the shoreline of Sitka Sound, the second highest since the department began keeping records. In the 1970s, spawning was often seen on less than 15 miles of shoreline, and the total biomass of herring was thought to be around 20,000 tons, a number which the harvest level is now approaching. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The U.S. Census Bureau has released the detailed 2010 census data for Alaska, but a leading economist says some media outlets are misreading the data that breaks down the population by race. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The total population in Alaska is 710,231, and over 473,000 Alaskans describe themselves as white. The American Indian and Alaska Native population stands at 104,871, but Neil Freed says that number is a bit misleading. Freed is an economist with the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. He says many Alaskans may be confused by a graph that was published in Wednesday's edition of the Anchorage Daily News. Freed says the graph showed the Alaska Native population growing by 7%, while the overall statewide population grew by 13%.
And that's simply not true. If you look at what they call, you know, Native alone, the alone race data, it is true. But the problem is there's this now this way you can count yourself in two or more races. You know, you can identify yourself that way, and a disproportionate percent of Alaska Natives fall into that category, so it can be misleading if you don't understand that technical problem with the data.
The graph used by the Anchorage Daily News came from the U.S. Census Bureau, and it showed that between the years 2000 and 2010, the number of Alaskans who described themselves as two or more races rose from 31,100 to over 51,800. That's a growth rate of 52%. Neil Freed says that's not true.
That didn't happen. What happened is that over time, we're identifying our same selves to some extent differently than we used to.
Freed says the Alaska Redistricting Board and others who use the census data for Alaska should note some other changes in place for the 2010 census that were not in effect for the 2000 census.
Like Prudhoe Bay, they counted thousands of people, and we've never done that before because the people in Prudhoe Bay have, in the past have never been considered residents because it's your usual place of residence. They've usually just taken them all out and put them wherever they sort of lived. Now there's a very large group that they are counting in Prudhoe Bay, which is interesting. But that's just a whole break, and so you can't look at that data. It's not consistent.
The Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development has created a special website that contains the 2010 census data for Alaska. You can find a link to that website at labor.state.ak.us. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD. Paper applications are available at the same 270 statewide locations as last year. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Former Department of Natural Resources Commissioner and Fort Knox mine engineer Tom Irwin is being tapped by a company hoping to develop a gold mine at Livengood north of Fairbanks. Livengood project manager for International Tower Hill subsidiary Talon Gold, Carl Honeman, says Irwin will develop a design for the proposed open pit hard rock mine.
Tom is going to join us as a construction manager. It's very early in the process to be thinking about construction, but we think that's actually the best time to be thinking about it, to incorporate his experience in operating successfully at Fort Knox, to incorporate those ideas and experience into our design so that we build a solid project that properly reflects our environmental stewardship values and will lead to our long-term success.
International Tower Hill has leased mineral rights on a 2-mile-wide-by-8-mile-long strip of primarily state land east of the Elliott Highway and south of the old Live and Good town site. Honeman says the company is spending $50 million on project development, including drilling and design work. Honeman says about 100 people are currently working on site. A pre-feasibility study will be completed by the end of the year. After that, the project will undergo public review and permitting. A Juneau man is up for an award given by recipients of the Congressional Medal of Honor. Bruce Bowler is one of 20 finalists for the Citizen Service Before Self honors bestowed upon ordinary people who either commit a single act of bravery or demonstrate a lifetime of putting service to others above themselves. Bowler was nominated for founding Sea Dogs, Southeast Alaska dogs organized for ground search. He's led his team of canines and human handlers on more than 700 search and rescue missions over nearly 35 years. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Of all the rescues Bruce Bowler's been on, one that stuck with him involved a 15-year-old girl who ran into the woods with her uncle's shotgun intent on killing herself. That is, until Bowler's dog Sheba found the girl.
Sheba, in her exuberance and her happiness to be finding this young woman, had gotten her mind off of pulling the trigger.
State troopers were able to talk the teen out of the woods, and today she's married and has two kids. Bowler founded Sea Dogs in 1977, not long after the tragic death of 11-year-old Rusty Dersma on Mount Juneau. After getting lost on a hike, Dersma fell down a ravine, and despite one of the largest search and rescue operations in Juneau history, died of hypothermia before rescuers could find him. A few weeks later, an acquaintance mentioned to Bowler that authorities might have had an easier time finding the boy if they'd had search dogs.
I'd never heard of search dog. What is a search dog? So we got to be chatting, and I just happened to have a dog with a good head on her shoulders and a burning desire to please and an ability to be able to get around in the outdoors. And we started Sea Dogs right after that.
In the early years, Sea Dogs worked statewide, but covering an area from Attu to Barrow to Ketchikan isn't exactly realistic, so Bowler helped convince others in Alaska's search and rescue community to start their own search dog organizations.
At present, we have a search and rescue dog team in Sitka, one in Ketchikan, one in Anchorage, one in Fairbanks, and I believe we have search and rescue dogs in Kodiak, who are part of Kaisar, Kodiak Island Search and Rescue.
It can take up to 2 years for canines to become certified in search and rescue. But for the dogs that can hack it, Bowler says it's like a big game of hide and seek.
Great fun for the dogs. We take people and put them in a place where we can replicate searches that we've actually been involved with here in Southeast Alaska that can train the dogs to this great game of search and rescue, which is what canine search and rescue is really all about.
Oh, good girl, good girl, show me.
Willow, a 6-year-old golden retriever, is a bundle of nervous energy as she signals to her handler that she's found the missing victim. Lucky for the humans involved, this scenario is fake. Part of the training Sea Dogs do 3 days a week to keep their skills in search and rescue sharp. Mark O'Brien is Willow's handler. He's been involved with Sea Dogs since 1982 and is not surprised Bowler's being recognized for his work.
he's got to get up in the middle of the night, get out of bed, you know, going outside, 35 degrees, pouring down rain, and, you know, and try to help the person that's lost out there in the woods. Their family's upset. Everybody wants to find them. And so, you know, you're putting the community and that service ahead of oneself.
Bowler was nominated for the Citizen Service Before Self Honor by former Juneau Mayor Sally Smith, who now works in the local office of U.S. Senator Mark Begich. Smith says she's only met Bowler a handful of times, but as someone who's been around Southeast Alaska for many years, his name instantly came to mind when she received the nomination form.
It was as though his name just went right onto the page. I read through what they were looking for, and it was just, you know, search and rescue. Who started it here? Bruce. Bam.
Winners of the Citizen Service Before Self Awards are chosen by members of the Congressional Medal of Honor Society, recipients of the nation's highest military decoration. Fewer than 90 medal recipients are alive today, and Bowler, an Air Force veteran, says just to be recognized by such an exclusive group is overwhelming.
I've had an opportunity to meet two of the recipients of the Congressional Medal of Honor, and they're just outstanding people who have done incredibly brave things in times of amazing stress, and to be selected by that small group of people is humbling.
Of course, Bowler didn't found Sea Dogs for awards and recognition. He says everyone in Alaska's search and rescue community would agree they do it because they love it.
There's always that potential outcome of bringing somebody back alive. And any time that we can get that opportunity to go and spend time in the backwoods, you know, twist my arm, make me do it. I think that's why we all live up here.
Of the 20 finalists for the Citizen Service Before Self Honors, three winners will be announced Monday, March 21st, and honored at a ceremony near the Tomb of the Unknowns at Arlington National Cemetery on Friday, March 25th, which is National Medal of Honor Day. Each of the finalists will receive a certificate recognizing their achievement. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Jacob Resnick in Kodiak, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Jake Neer in Barrow, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees. And by AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
If you are an individual owner of Indian Trust land, an IIM account holder, or heir to an Indian Trust landowner or account holder, you may be eligible to receive money from a $3.4 billion federal settlement. To get a detailed written notice about the settlement that explains your legal rights, you may visit IndianTrust.com or call 1-800-961-6109. This message is sponsored by the Native American Trust. ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.